Hello, it is May 28th, 2014. This is episode 423 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. Today's death, Jeremiah Carlton, who died May 28th, 1790. I found little to no information on Carlton outside of the This Day in Death's roundups I go through to put together these intros, so it's possible that none of this is true. But it's so compelling, I must simply quote the one line. Here goes. Jeremiah Carlton was the laziest man in history. He inherited a fortune at 19, went to bed, and stayed there for the next 70 years until he died at the age of 89. I have no idea what his fortune was, or why he stayed in bed, or whether any of this has any validity and any verisimilitude, as they say. But there it is. If it is true, I hope someone paid him, or he paid someone else, I guess, to flip him over occasionally. Bedsores, and, you know. Here in Athens, though, it is merely Wednesday. I'm Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. I've got the World Cup fever. I can't wait for the World Cup to start. I'm really excited. It's amazing the number of things I know about Algeria's soccer team right now. I've really been studying. So one of the greatest study guides for me, and I think anyone that, if you have that question of, I want to get into the World Cup, but I feel like I don't, not only, forget that I'm not knowing all the players, because I feel like that's asking a lot, but know really what's at stake in these games, not just for the team itself, but for the country that's so passionate about them. Well, to me, the best resource I found for this, and there's been plenty, but the best one I've come across is actually a book by today's guest. Today's guest is Harrison Stark. He is the author of the book, The Globalized Game, A Geopolitical Guide to the 2014 World Cup, which is currently available on Amazon. It's actually an ebook. You can get it for like $3 or $4 or $2. It's really cheap. I didn't even notice that I paid for it. And I came away understanding everything that was going on in this World Cup. He's also the lead purveyor of The Spot, which is the new World Cup blog from Slate. He'll be writing throughout the World Cup on that as well. He's really good. He's Harrison Stark, and he's here with me now. All right, first off, Mr. Stark, thank you for coming on with me. I'm a big fan of the book. The book, as I said in the intro, is The Globalized Game, A Geopolitical Guide to the 2014 World Cup. And, of course, you were the lead purveyor of The Spot, Slate's World Cup blog. Thank you for coming on with me, sir.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, now, one of the things I love about your book is, you know, obviously the notion of a country's geopolitical situation and their soccer team. You know, it's something that's been written about before, but I feel like you do a really good job of tying those things together in a logical way that makes me understand, frankly, not just the teams better, but the countries, because I'm a Midwesterner. I'm landlocked. I've never been anywhere. But before we get into that, obviously I think people are still talking about the Landon Donovan news. We're pre-taping this a little earlier, so this is a little newer to us than it might be to you listening. But obviously for a lot of people, on one hand, it is a shock. On the other hand, it's not like Donovan and Klinsmann have been best pals and these longtime compatriots. What were your thoughts when you saw that Donovan didn't make the team?
Well, first of all, I think it still is a surprise. I mean, of course, there's been tension between Donovan and Klinsmann before. I think when you look at Donovan's record, it's tough to make the argument that he doesn't deserve to be there, especially when you look at some of the greener faces on the team, not to make a joke, but right. Like Julian Green, a player with only one or two caps, negligible club experience, and who looked wholly out of his depth when he pulls on a USA shirt. It's tough to think that having Donovan at home, unable to steady some of those players who are at the Cup for the first time, it's a wise move.
The Green thing, I don't know if it's a one-to-one, like Green's on the team because Donovan isn't. But Green, I think that a lot of people, true. I think, that defend Klinsmann. I think the idea is, listen, to get Green to not play for Germany, he's about 18, he had the promise of a Cup spot, which may be true and maybe not be true. But this looks like, in a lot of ways, it's obviously everyone's excited for the World Cup this year, but this looks to me like two things. One, a 2018 is maybe a little bit more important than Klinsmann than 2014 is, and two, that Klinsmann felt like he needed to make some sort of psychological break from the U.S. team before him and the U.S. team after. Does that make sense?
I think that's definitely true. And in terms of leaving his mark on the team and kind of creating a lot of buzz around his own team, I think it's tough to argue that it hasn't been effective. This is the first time I've ever come home, turned onto a news site, and American soccer is actually headline news. And so the shock exclusion of Donovan, it's the first time I've ever seen a soccer story go viral here in the States that's really about an American team. And so in that way, he might even be generating more buzz before the team gets to Brazil.
Do you think, because I was at the USA Mexico qualifier, the one where they qualify for the World Cup in Columbus, and there, and Grant Wall's written a lot about this as well, about how there appears to be, like, maybe it's not going to work this year. We obviously know, historically speaking, about how the United States is not always been a soccer country. It does seem to me that the fan-wise, with the American Outlaws and the ratings for that we saw from NBC's coverage, and it, and even the amount of money that the MLS got in its television package, it would seem to me that soccer is moving in a positive direction in the United States. And the supposed sleeping giant that everyone is kind of waiting for America to be, it seems like it's a possibility. You seem in your book maybe a little bit more skeptical of that.
Well, I think it's growing steadily. In certain ways, it's stagnating in others. What's interesting about soccer is it is steadily growing, but it's steadily growing in a very niche way. A lot of folks have commented on the New York Times article about soccer finding a certain intellectual currency with a creative class in New York. And I think more and more soccer will come to be that. Less a kind of die-hard, red-blooded American sport, more, again, a sort of intellectual currency for a more cosmopolitan, sort of internationally minded Americans. I mean, if you look
I call it
at the success of,
I call it hipster patriotism.
really, and I think that's what it is. And when you look at the success of these very niche publications like Howler or 8x8, which are as much about a sort of creative class design aesthetic as it is about soccer content. Not that their content's not good, it's
Of
excellent,
course, of course.
but the presentation value is through the roof. And the fact that it's finding traction with that group, I think, is a real indicator of where soccer is going in the States. I think also, folks point to this as insignificant, but more Americans are playing FIFA, the EA Sports video game, than ever before. And if you listen to the FIFA soundtrack, it's kind of that aesthetic as well. It's sort of an indie pop, very international, in different languages. And I think if you were to sort of extrapolate out from the FIFA soundtrack sound, you would get the group that soccer is growing with. Whether or not that will translate into success on the field, it's tough to say. I think for us to be really a world power, soccer is going to need to take root in a more traditional sense and displace a little bit the holy trinity of basketball, baseball, and football.
When, this is something, this is another reason that I think that they left, they gave Klinsmann the extension for 2018, even before this World Cup. A, because of the group of death is, I mean, it's a tough group to say the least, and maybe we can get into that. But also this notion that, and he's talked, I think, openly that is about the goal is kind of not, like, obviously he wants to win, but the goal is to change the culture in a lot of ways. And I wrote a piece for Sports on Earth about this a few weeks ago. About, I found it fascinating. He gave this quote to USA Today, saying that he really feels, and your book gets about this, gets into this well, as well, about how the culture in the United States is very coach oriented, and the and this the, and it's like American football. I think you actually have this line in the book about how American football, the idea is the coach tells you guys to go do this, and they go do it, and so much of American sports culture is based in the idea the coach is in charge and the players try to execute what the coach wants them to do. And that is not really how internationally soccer is coached. And you've seen Klinsmann talk about that idea specifically of like we need to get away from this idea that that the coaches the players in charge in a lot of ways. Do you think Klinsmann A has the power of personality to do that, and B, particularly now that he's made such like this, I don't know if he realizes it or not. I mean, he's a smart man. You think he would, but you know the average soccer, the average American, if they know one soccer player, it's Landon Donovan and Pele. You know, so like, you know, do you think that he may have hurt his case by not putting Donovan on the team in a public relations aspect?
I think there will be some backlash. I think especially if the United States really falters in Brazil. I mean, we're in a very tough group. I think few genuinely tip us to advance. Having said that, you know, we play a hardworking, scrappy game and we don't go down easy. If we were to get routed in Brazil, which I think is unlikely, actually, even though I do think we'll be eliminated in the first round, I think then the knives could be sharpened around Klinsmann a little bit. But I think he is starting to break that cult of personality around the coach. And what he has done is he has expanded the player pool in an interesting way. I mean, for a long time, most American players came through the college system. You know, Bruce Arena, you know, coached college and was historically less inclined to take players, you know, with dual nationalities who hadn't gone through the American system. I mean, the fact that Klinsmann is able to secure the signatures of players like Green, like Johansson, and kind of open up that pool of dual nationality, I think he's already changing the culture within the camp.
Do you think that, and this is the last question on the U.S. team, you know, I remember Brian Strauss's piece for then Sporting News. Now he's a Sports Illustrated, but for, you read about this in the book about that famous piece where all the players anonymously, not all the players, but a lot of some of the players, at least two said anonymously that they were very frustrated with Klinsmann, that he seemed to be more of a it just wasn't really working. Now they went out after that and got hot and won a bunch of games. Everyone's kind of forgotten about that story a little bit, but I wonder. You know, we forget how that wasn't that long ago. Like, I think it was right before the snow game, as a matter of fact.
And absolutely.
So I'm curious that, you know, you followed Klinsmann's career for a long time. Is this a problem he had in Germany? Like, is this like the absolute faith that we have in Klinsmann? Are we right to do that? Is he going to lose some of that with Donovan?
So I agree. I mean, that piece generated a lot of buzz when it first came out. People have kind of forgotten about it. And I think, you know, was it a dark time during qualification? When we got hot, a lot of journalists and pundits and fans alike kind of just dismissed those comments as sour grapes. Having said that, those comments are awfully consistent with his reputation in Germany, where players like Philipp Lahm, who, you know, Pep Guardiola referred to Lahm as the most intelligent player he'd ever coached. You know, Lahm publicly criticized Klinsmann in his book as having no tactical knowledge whatsoever. And the consensus in a lot of the German media now is that the success of the German team under Klinsmann was really down to the tactical know-how of Jogi Löw, who's the now, you know, full German coach. And so, you know, I think it's tough to know if those were fringe players in the Strauss piece just kind of, you know, stirring the pot. Having said that, those criticisms are consistent with his reputation in Germany, which is that he's sort of more of a motivational life coach, albeit a good motivational life coach, than your typical German tactician.
All right, so now I don't want to spend too much more time on the U.S. team. I want to talk about specifically about the book, since the book is some of the things you say in the book. And I know you're counting down still on the Slate site, your prediction. So I'm not going to spoil anything, though.
I appreciate it.
Of course. But I do want to ask you specifically about some of the specifically England. You know, there is this notion, I think, among England soccer fans, that, you know, that you have this wonderful quote in there. I forget the writer, Simon Cooper maybe, who talks about the cycle of what England fans go through for watching this. But I'm curious, when you like, do you think it seems to me that a lot of England soccer fans, they seem more optimistic this year than usual. Not so much optimistic they're going to win, but it feels like there's less pressure this time, just because they're a younger team and so on.
True.
But you make the argument kind of that England really isn't that great anyway, and this is kind of an illusion to think they'd ever be a real competitor.
So that, in a nutshell, is Simon Cooper's argument, is that when you look at the indicators of what predicts soccer success, England actually overperformed. I do think this year is a little bit different, and expectations, at least initially, were down a little bit. I mean, this kind of continued cycle of England getting itself worked up before a tournament and then crashing out, you know, it has started to kind of take its toll. And there have been more public criticisms of the way that England has handled its youth development recently. You know, prominent players like Rio Ferdinand criticized the system. Terry Redknapp, who was tipped before Hodgson to get the England seat, came out with a pretty scathing assessment of the Football Association's youth programs. So there's this acknowledgement that England is not well positioned to compete with countries like Spain or the Netherlands or even France in terms of developing a good youth program. Having said that, I think that the hype was delayed more than anything else. I mean, first the expectations were down, then Liverpool almost won the title with a core group of English players and folks started to get excited again. The young team does take some of the pressure off, but it's, again, you know, folks are very expectant of players like Luke Shaw, Ross Barkley, Daniel Sturridge, Raheem Sterling, and, you know, even today, you know, there's headlines about, you know, all eyes on Wayne Rooney, this is going to be his tournament to shine, which have been the headlines at every Euro and right. World Cup since Wayne Rooney made his debut. And so I think the hype will start again. Having said that, they're in a very tough group, and I think there's an acknowledgement that it's going to be tough to slip past Italy and Uruguay, particularly if Suarez gets fit in time for the Cup.
Now, one of the things that is great about the World Cup, of course, is that, you know, not only are all these teams have all these different styles, they're in many ways tied in to the national character in a lot of ways, and they play Germany all countries being a great, kind of great example. And it's interesting though, because you make two points I want to hit on in the book that I thought were fascinating. First is this idea that do you think that notion of each of these individual nations having their own culture. You make the argument in the book a little bit that is something that as the years go forward, we might lose a little bit.
I think that's true. So exactly. The argument is in a nutshell that, you know, soccer is played in every country in the world. Its scope goes well beyond that of any single religion. You know, almost a third of the planet watched the last World Cup final together. I mean, you know, it's a third of humanity doing something at the same time. And whereas, you know, dance, music, marriage, and birth and death rites are everywhere but kind of infinite in their diversity, soccer is played by the same rules everywhere. And so by definition, it becomes kind of a common denominator, something that transcends sport. And by looking at the ways that countries play soccer but also talk about soccer, you can get a sense of certain cultural energies or vectors in that country. Historically, that has been one of the reasons to watch the World Cup, all these different geopolitical styles on display. Now, as you mentioned, I think, you know, that in some ways is the thesis of the book. But the other thesis of the book is that thesis is not going to be true for very much longer.
Right.
That essentially, first of all, the entire idea of kind of nationalism and national character is very much out of fashion. And in a new, to use a word I don't love all the time, even though it's in the title, a new globalized world, these national divisions are meaning less and less every day. And a lot of the world powers that meet at soccer, the geopolitical events that really gave these matches a lot of their teeth and charge are a long time in the past. I mean, for a long time, World War II was the driving force for a lot of these European rivalries, or the Falklands War between Argentina and England. That's not to say that geopolitical conflicts don't exist in the world. They absolutely do. But the same countries tend to make it to the World Cup again and again, and the conflicts that sustain those rivalries are beginning to become relics of the past. Also, if the idea of nationalism is going out of fashion, it's going out of fashion even more quickly within soccer. FIFA eligibility rules are notoriously slack. So today, players have their choice to play for a number of countries, which makes the diffuse movement of players more proliferated than ever. So, for example, Adnan Januzaj is this, you know, was the breakout star of Manchester United's terrible season this year, but was one of the few players to emerge with any credibility. He could have chosen to play for England, Belgium, Kosovo, Serbia, I believe, and you know, eventually he chose Belgium. But he's more the norm than the exception, a player who can choose a multitude of nationalities. And Lionel Messi is a good example. The captain of Argentina, you know, considered to be the best player in the world, and there's a debate about whether or not he's the best of all time. But he's been living in Barcelona since he was 12 years old. And so there's a question among Argentines if he's more Catalan or compatriot. And so I think as, you know, players more and more are kind of citizens of nowhere and more citizens of their clubs, these national styles will become more and more diffuse. And these national rivalries will mean less and less.
So, and that leads into, I think, another point that you make, which is interesting, is that it feel like the, obviously the World Cup is the biggest event, biggest sporting event on the planet. I think it's difficult to argue otherwise. And but it does, you know, one of the things that I think hurts Americans a little bit sometimes, not in this sport, but in general, is that, you know, we like the U.S. Olympic basketball team. We're into it. We root for them, but they're not the Knicks. Like the Knicks are like they're not the Knicks. They're not the sure. Lakers. We don't have the passion for that team. That we do for our club teams, as we might call it, and it seems, you know, you make an argument at the beginning of the book that maybe do you think the popularity of the club teams is ultimately going to hurt the World Cup, and that people will take their club teams more, some of the players will take their club teams more seriously than the World Cup? Have we seen that yet, or is that something that you expect to see down the line?
No, I think absolutely. I think that, first of all, as much as we wish it were otherwise, the clubs play the payers' wages. And I make the argument in the book that there's a chance that the World Cup will become something like the All-Star Game, an honorable exhibition game, but something that the players don't take too seriously because it has no impact on their club careers. And, you know, a player makes very, very little money playing for his or her national team. So if a player gets hurt at the World Cup, it has very, very profound impact on their club career. And we had a case a couple of years ago where Robin van Persie was injured on duty for the Netherlands, and Arsene Wenger threatened to sue the Dutch Federation. And so there's a real conflict and tension between clubs and their national teams. More than that, these clubs, especially the bigger clubs like Manchester United, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Real Madrid, are so zealous in their pursuit for young talent that they collect these players at a younger and younger age. And so I already gave the example of Messi, but you know, if you're 7 or 8 years old and you're plucked from your country of origin and you go to live at one of these youth academies at a top European club, that club, in a sense, becomes your home, becomes the institution or body to which you owe your allegiance. There's a famous example. In the 2006 World Cup, Portugal was playing the Netherlands, and it was called the Battle of Nuremberg because there were so many yellow and red cards. It was an incredibly dirty game. But as it turned out, a Dutch player, Giovanni van Bronckhorst, got sent off within the same span of time as a Portuguese player, Deco. You know, this is an international match. They're at each other's throats. But both players played their club football for Barcelona. So there's a famous shot of the camera panning the crowd, and both the players, you know, who had just been playing against each other only moments before, are sitting next to each other in the stands, amicably laughing and kind of, you know, bantering small talk. And so that was kind of the first iconic moment where you felt like club football was beginning to eclipse international soccer.
Is the passion of the fans and the citizens enough to offset that? Or, like, it seems like, like the PR of someone saying, "I'm not willing to push it to play for, say, Spain." Spain would be a bad example, but to play for, mm-hmm. you know, for Argentina or so on. I don't want to hurt myself because I'm getting these guys paying me the other way. Do the club, like right now, it'd be bad PR for a club team to say something like that, or for a player to say something like that. But is that, like, do you think it's eroding just at the player level? The fans certainly don't seem to feel that way.
No, I agree, and I think right now it would be political suicide for a player to attempt that. Do I think 2 or 3 World Cups from now you'll see star players, you know, ooh, at the last second, not quite able to make the team because they've got this niggle, this unnamed injury that doesn't allow them to make the squad. I think that'll be more and more likely until we get to the point that it's sort of tacitly acknowledged that that's what's happening to international soccer. Unless, of course, you know, it's a smaller team. I mean, the exception of to this rule is if players are really gunning for visibility or a team has a lot to prove. And I think that's one of the factors in why Brazil will be a force at this World Cup. I mean, there is so much expectation riding on them. They kind of have to take it with an intensity that other teams might not feel that pressure for.
Now, I guess this is my last question because I want to ask this of everyone I talk to about the World Cup. Where are you? You're not going, right? You're not going, right?
No, okay. I'm not. I will be here.
So, what's your watching setup? Because I find this fascinating. Because I feel like one of the things I love about the World Cup is it happens during, you know, a relatively slow time in the sport, the American sports calendar.
Oh yeah.
And this year the times are perfect. This is not like South Korea and Japan where the games were, mm-hmm. you know, you'd be leaving the bar after a really late night and people were coming in to watch the, I guess that was my experience, but that wasn't everyone's experience.
Yeah.
I'm curious, are you, what's your show? You're just going to sit and watch and take notes the whole time? Like to me, one of the things I love about this World Cup, this can just become an all-day thing, like all day, every day for a month.
Oh, it's great! It's great, and I wish I could spend all day, every day, just watching the games. I'm lucky enough to live in Washington D.C., which is great international town. Yeah. A lot of great soccer bars, and there's a lot of great soccer bars with allegiances to clubs or nationalities. And so, if I could wave a magic wand, I'll kind of make the rounds from one Ghanaian bar to one Spanish bar, the one Ecuadorian bar, you know, and so on and so forth. But it's gonna be a heck of a ride.
Is there one? I'm curious. Is there one nation's bar that you think would be the most exciting to be there for? Is there one you feel like you don't want to that's the craziest fan base that you want to be around for a game?
I got to be honest. Unfortunately, they're not at this World Cup. In 2010, I went to a South African bar in New York, and it was the most fun I've ever had watching a soccer game.
Oh, that's and of course, as you wrote about the book, like, you know, that was all the African teams all kind of came together on that when they were all rooting for mm-hmm. and it's fine. And this is the last thing I have for you, because to me it's fine. Not only is the U.S.'s group the most competitive group, I actually find it almost the most compelling group storyline wise.
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways, the U.S. are actually the least interesting story in that group, because I feel like across the board they're all fascinating. Germany has all these injuries. Portugal, of course, has Ronaldo, and everyone to them works with Ronaldo. And then Ghana, which has really kind of been the star-crossed team of all the wild World Cups, correct?
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of folks who will be rooting, a lot of neutrals will be rooting for Ghana as kind of spiritual retribution for what happened in 2010.
Yeah.
And they play very slick, attractive, counter-attacking football. So they're tough not to like. I think the U.S.'s group will be the most entertaining by a significant margin. Although Group B with Australia, Spain, Chile, and the Netherlands will also have some very, very attractive football on display.
So if the U.S. loses, the U.S., they probably have to not even tie. They need to beat Ghana in that first game to have any chance, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, sir, thank you for your time. I love the book. The book is The Globalized Game, A Geopolitical Guide to the 2014 World Cup. And your stuff is going to – and you're going to be regularly on the spot both before – on Slate's World Cup blog, both before and during the World Cup, correct?
This will run up until the World Cup starts. And, we'll see what happens after that.
Okay, fantastic. Well,
but,
sir.
You so much, Will. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be on the show. I hope the Stars and Stripes can make it out, although I'm not too optimistic.
That's okay. That's right. I'm just sorry for all the people that yelled at you for having so low.
There's more to come.
I'm sure there is. All right. Thank you for your time. Keep it great work, and everyone go buy the book. Take care, sir.
Thanks, Will. Appreciate it.
All right. So as you can probably tell from that, we did that shortly after, not shortly after, but some not that long after the Landon Donovan decision, a decision that you may be very tired of hearing about by now, but was compelling to us at the time, and frankly, I think it's still compelling. Regardless, thank you, to Harrison Stark. You can follow him on Twitter, at Harrison Stark, H-A-R-R-I-S-O-N-S-T-A-R-K. And make sure to buy his book, The Globalized Game, a geopolitical guide to the 2014 World Cup. You can get that on Amazon for a frighteningly small amount of money. And of course, check out the Spot, Slate's World Cup blog. This has been the Willis Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Thursday's guest is Paul Pabst. He is producer of the Dan Patrick Radio Show and a graduate of Southern Illinois University. So we have plenty to talk about. I will chat with you and him then.